This episode is brought to you by the Muslim Voices Project at Indiana University. The project's mission is to counter Islamophobia by providing a platform for amplifying diverse local, regional, and global Muslim voices and critically dismantling Islamophobic discourse and representation. You can find them online at muslimvoices.indiana.edu and on Twitter at Muslim Voices. Today we have a very special guest. She is also from Lahore, Pakistan, so I'm already very, very excited to interview her. Shazia Sikandar is a visual artist who's had major solo exhibitions throughout the world, including the Wetherspoon Art Museum, North Carolina, the Asian Art Museum, San Francisco, the Aga Khan Museum, Toronto, the Asia Society Hong Kong Center, the Guggenheim Museum, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Washington, D.C., the Museum of Contemporary Art, Tokyo, and the list goes on. Shazia is also a self-proclaimed citizen of the world. And what's fascinating about her work is that it offers a different and more inclusive way that transcends geopolitical borders and radically disrupts assumptions around national, political, historical boundaries. She interrogates the idea of culture, identity, tradition. She questions if tradition is malleable or not. How does tradition evolve? Who are the gatekeepers of the tradition? And through her work, she disrupts those stereotypes that exist. I can't wait to share her interview with you. So let's get started.
I was also looking at how identity is so mercurial. Like, if I wore it now, is everybody going to think of me a certain way? If I took it off, is that going to become a gesture in of itself?
So hello again, how are you doing?
I'm good, how are you? Good to be in conversation here today.
Yes, and for listeners who may not know this, you and I actually had a phone conversation a couple of days ago, and what was apparently a formal call to discuss recording logistics turned out into this hour-long heart-to-heart. And by the way, when I hung up, I was like, damn it, if I had my recorder on, I could have recorded that conversation and shared it with our listeners. So Shazia, I want to start with your story. To me, the way I see you and your work, art comes to you so effortlessly. And most of what you do artistically is shaped by your childhood and your experiences as a kid growing up under dictatorship. I want you to share your story, your life journey thus far.
Okay. Well, we can, you know, definitely it'll unfold as we continue our conversation. But I grew up in Pakistan. I came to the U.S. in 1993. So before that, growing up, definitely in the 80s, you know, that's in the background is the military dictatorship, which is the Soviet, Afghan, U.S. Pak War, which is, 1978 to 1992, right? So that is definitely that time of so much change that's going on, you know. There's a specific sort of polarization happening between the public and private spaces, also culturally. And I think at that time, you know, it kind of signaled a discouraging notion towards dissent and even creative expression. So that sort of shift in the culture that I think was very instrumental in some way in how I found myself wanting to go into the direction of humanities and, you know, eventually visual art. That's definitely, there's that, the blasphemy laws, there's the emergence of those, there's the Hudud ordinances, which were kind of hovering. So you do see the shift in human rights and women's rights in a broader space.
So what was the environment like at home? What did your parents do?
So the household, you know, grew up in a very multi-generational with grandparents, father's parents, and in one house with uncles, aunts, lots of cousins, so different families. So we grew up in that sort of household. And also in the 80s, my father also took a job in Somalia. So there was a time when exposure to Mogadishu, to going to another Muslim country, especially, you know, Somalia, this is an earlier period before the wars and the famine. In early childhood, you also got a very interesting kind of sense and juxtapositioning of the range in Muslim experiences. So that's also, and especially exposure to Africa. So that for me is kind of was very instrumental also in how I was understanding how language shifts, language around identity and culture, and how to see things from multiple perspectives. But within the household, yes, it was, you know, it was a very interesting mix of, you may call it the spiritual, secular Muslimness.
Huh.
And there, I think I was always very close to my grandparents also. And, you know, there was always a respect for listening and speaking your mind, and an encouragement towards sharing, communicating. So so I always felt that I was supported in my desire and attempt to sort of, as I grew as a younger child, to be able to participate in conversations.
When did you know you were interested in art? Because in a lot of Pakistani households, and I don't want to stereotype or generalize, but there is this expectation of certain professions. For girls especially, it's like, you know, you become a doctor. That's the prevalent narrative that we hear. But you were interested in something different. When were you able to verbalize that? And what was your parents' reaction?
I was good at drawing, I think, from an early childhood. But I was actually quite a good student. So I was good at a lot of things, very much a studious kid. And and art came much later for me as a clear picture of like, this is the direction I'm going to engage with. But, you know, earlier in school, high school, I was just, I knew that I was good with the facility of drawing and be able to also communicate through the language of drawing. But it was never something that was like, oh, this is a direction that I'm going to pursue professionally. It was it was just one of the many things that were part of the learning experience. It's later, I think, when I was at the Kinnaird College for Women and studying language and even mathematics and, you know, economics. And at that time, I think I got interested that I was curious about the National College of Art. I was gravitating towards it. But there are a couple of, I think a couple of experiences. One would be Women Action Forum was very much active at that time, and some of the founding members. I was engaged with the late artist Lala Roh, and did an internship or worked with their office, which was mostly, I think, the publication part of it. It was under the name Seymour Foundation. I remember working with Seymour Foundation, being definitely being encouraged by Lala Roh to sort of look at the National College of Arts. And, you know, at that time, when you think that these are the crossroads that you're learning how women's rights issues, as well as what is community, what is art, how art starts to intersect in those zones. There's these kind of things that start to create a momentum where one is wanting to go in the direction where, you know, where you're going to explore expression. You're going to like question the shifts in culture and how do you participate. So language of art seemed much more natural to me.
And then how did you end up in the US?
Yeah, so Kinnaird, of course, was a normal place for a lot of women to go. It's a college for women. And I think over there, I was a little bit bored. I was a little bit like, everybody seems to be waiting for this, you know, kind of a phase of like marriage. And there's this it was a very cultural thing, at least in my generation. And so to go to the National College of Art at that time was quite radical. It wasn't something that, you know, that was being encouraged. It's definitely not how it is now in recent years. So I did have to fight for that within my family. And I think to make them understand that, first of all, a career in the arts wasn't really about just a career. It was more like I wanted to like understand and explore and participate in a broader conversation. So initially, it was like, okay, if you study architecture, I think that was more relatable to at least parents. And so it was a slow process, right? So finally, when I'm there, and then while at NCF for 4 or even more years, I gravitated in the direction of tradition. You know, you have to really see that at that time, everything is still a little bit, it's very westernized models of education. So we have this whole colonial history. So like studying other things that would be more prevalent than a focused engagement with the traditional languages, visual languages from the region or even broader region, Central Asia, South Asia. So understanding like the term miniature painting. So there was a department miniature painting and it was the least popular. There was just like, either you did it as a side thing to get extra marks or, you know, just a secondary thing, but you'd never majored in it. And I gravitated to that culture. Like I wanted to question why we have a department which seemed to gain attention as soon as there was a foreign entity being introduced into the school, or like, look at our culture. Yeah. But outside of that, there was just a disregard, or this kind of dismissive approach, dismissive gesture. And that interested me a lot because I think intuitively that was about how the colonial baggage persists.
Exactly. But talking about miniature painting, now that requires a lot of discipline. And I'm not an artist, but I have some idea of how it works. How long did it take you to cultivate the amount of discipline needed to do miniature painting?
Many years. All those years at NCA, my time was literally like 10, 14, 15 hours every day.
Wow.
But it was also the nature of the relationship with the master teacher, Bashir Ahmed. He expected that and demanded that. He was always at the school. So, you know, I think there was this moment where he recognizes that he has a student who's coming to it in a very serious manner. And I was also aware that at that time, there was very little interest in my peers in studying miniature painting and dedicating to its language as a major subject, right? So there's this kind of this shift that happens where I take on miniature painting and he is available to cultivate that dynamic. And based on that, there's like a 4 or 5 years of working and, you know, learning the techniques and all. It was just the nature of the game. I was equally interested in analyzing it as like acquiring language and what it meant to further that language, how to speak back in that language. So it was never kind of I had a broader vision. I knew intuitively that there was a lot of potential here.
So you started working on it for a reason. There was a trigger. You were trying to challenge the colonial mindset that's pretty much prevalent even to this day in Pakistan. But once you started doing miniature painting, was it as interesting as you had anticipated? Did you just take on miniature painting as a challenge? And when was it that you developed interest for it?
Yeah, well, because the interest you cultivate, right? My reasoning to go into the art school was very clear. Like I knew that for me, art was not just about a hobby. Or for me, art was really about change. It had the potential for change. It was always about how to think outside of the box, how to come up with creative solutions. It was about, how ideas are generated and then the fruition towards an idea. Yeah. Like how do you, that type of thinking is creative thinking. So for me, art was really about problem solving through creative thinking.
So what was the problem you were trying to solve through miniature painting?
Yes. So the problem itself, I think, was what we understood as tradition. Because I think at that time, everything around me was dictating that tradition was bad and inferior. And an artist had to be modern to be avant-garde. So when you think of that and you think, okay, miniature painting is pre-colonial history, was its history, how it's being consumed and shared and talked about was also coming from a very Orientalist colonial perspective. Mm. So then if you want to understand the broader practice, you have to think about the English colonial era, the dispersion, the revival of the arts, within the institution itself. So in that sense, the identity of Pakistani art was very much in flux. If you think of it like that, then, immediately you start recognizing that there's a sort of a deep stigma in how we understand and identify with tradition.
And that's so true for other aspects of tradition as well. When we look at language, I feel like even when I was growing up, and I'm sure it's true for you, the idea of being fluent in Urdu was in a way stigmatized.
Yeah, unfortunately, these are such deep-rooted aspects of, I guess, a colonial baggage too. Things have not been, rooted out and challenged and readdressed. I recall in high school, and I went to the convent of Jesus and Mary. So, of course, that for your audience that doesn't understand, in northern India, in Pakistan, there's a whole history of the colonial schooling education too. So going to a Catholic school didn't necessarily mean that you had to be Catholic or you're non-Muslim. That history of like private schooling via Catholic schools versus very few, government schools that were around at that time. If your education is going through those channels, then you were aware because I think around grade 7 or 8, you would either go into matriculation where the Board of Education is local, right? And then, or you would go into O levels or A levels or Cambridge, whatever it was, senior Cambridge, right? So the shift would happen, right? Who was, the focus would be on English schooling. So that probably hasn't been dismantled. Obviously, there's more choices by now and more schools that have come into play, but those choices were very limited. So the pressure, I don't speak good Punjabi at all. And my mother is Punjabi speaking. And I wondered always like why we shied away. Why wasn't, the language cultivated better? Even Urdu. The highbrow Urdu, understanding Urdu poetry, I need assistance with that.
Yeah, no, and I think it was just frowned upon. And that is the irony of it all, right? It's a local language that we should all take pride in, but people in Pakistan don't take pride in it. And we are seeing a continuous erasure of our languages because of that, because there is no effort being put and there isn't a way to cultivate those languages and make them more palatable to the general population, I guess. Shazia, I want to talk about your art, how it represents or doesn't represent tradition, culture. What does authenticity mean? Now, in your words, your work stands in opposition to the idea of homogeneous and authentic national cultures. In fact, you ask instead that we understand these terms like tradition or culture and identity as unstable, abstract, and constantly evolving. In your opinion, what are some of the problematic outcomes of holding on to uniformity or that homogeneous idea of tradition and culture?
Culture, if anything, culture is unstable. It's all about change. And also, it's such an encyclical notions, right? So let's bring it back to looking at miniature painting, for example.
Right.
Let's explain that to your audience. Like, a lot of people don't necessarily actually understand what that term is. And right, that the term itself is problematic because it comes from the legacy of colonialism. So even as early as 1600s, there were encounters with the European merchant scholars that were in South Asia. So the encounters that they had with the visual traditions during that era, and then they start calling the manuscript painting traditions as miniatures, is also because they were visually similar to their traditions. So that term that gets placed in miniatures is a very colonial term.
I didn't know that.
And now there has begun a move that's kind of to move away from the term as those fields are being decolonized too. So in the background, now imagine that there are collectors in recent decades, particularly, that have continued to cut out and kind of disperse these paintings all over the world for profit. So when you think of miniature painting, it is really a very truncated history of the canon of visual traditions from Central and South Asia. So now imagine that a book of Kells or, any gospel, medieval Western manuscript, would it ever be ripped out one by one, their pages? Nobody would dare. Nobody has done that. And yet the traditions of such manuscript traditions from visual, actual illuminated manuscripts, books, etc., from India, Persia, Turkey, they have been ripped apart. And the genre itself is about destruction. It is about looting, plundering, and how you cannot disassociate that with its history and context. So in that sense, that's what has always been also a very core idea that I'm interested in pursuing. So I think of myself very much as a somebody who's like a detective, because I'm looking at art. And now, where is most of it? Most of it sits in Western museums' storages. So, there's a huge amount of art at the British Museum, at the British Library, at the Met, and many, many institutions in the West. And then, or in private collections, perhaps many that have yet to be published. When so much of that is not necessarily available, the archives are not necessarily accessible to people. So how do you really come to terms and understand what that visual history is that we are saying is, part of our heritage? That is what intrigues me, is that so much of it, unless it comes becomes visible through exhibitions, you don't necessarily know what some of the visual works are. And even if it does appear in exhibitions, if the exhibitions are always happening in the Western institutions, how much of that actually you can get to see? So growing up in Pakistan, learning miniature painting was, you never saw the actual work. Your relationship with, quote unquote, your own tradition was being cast through a facsimile.
Why do you think we are not seeing more of it in places like Pakistan?
Well, it is also, it's a direct legacy of colonial histories. It's been dispersed. It's been taken away. It's been looted or whatever. It doesn't exist in the region. And also Pakistan, we're talking about the historical documents, historical archives. We're talking about an era before Pakistan comes into being, right? This is early histories. It's pre-partition. That is just to give you guys, give you an idea of what the term miniature painting tradition comes from, what that encompasses. That's where I'm kind of my kind of niche. What I'm talking in particular about is the visual painterly traditions that are of a large, broad area, and Pakistan is part of it in terms of the region because it goes all the way into Central Asia and South Asia.
Talking about Pakistan, Shazia, I know you're a self-proclaimed citizen of the world, and there is something about being in another country that makes us reevaluate our previous ideas and feelings about our country of origin, or whatever we call home and wherever home is. Has your, move to the US, or have your travels shifted your perspective on Pakistan and Pakistani culture? How do you view it? And again, I want to talk about this in the context of authenticity, because sometimes I feel like as immigrants, when we leave our country of origin, by definition, people who are left behind see us or view us as less authentic. However, when we have kids and offspring in another country, we somehow see them less authentic. So in a way, all of us are trying to be gatekeepers of authenticity, right?
It's a, you know, it's a very vague term for that can be used or abused for something. For me, when as an artist making art, you are in dialogue with the artistic community, with the community. So if I'm making art, it is always in conversation with a broader consciousness, surrounded by it in immediate environments, or even in terms of how, even in my dialogue with history, right? My art is not performing my identity. So even if it was, each of us have their own identity to understand and present it as we understand it.
But has there been anything that you can see more clearly now? For instance, I feel like there are certain practices that I can call out more now since I am removed from those practices and I'm not as immersed in them. And there are certain things that I value more about Pakistan and Pakistani traditions because, again, I'm removed from them. And when I was growing up in Pakistan, I took some of it for granted.
Going back to, say, 93 is when I came to the U.S. My first time. Or like even in terms of the early, say, the first few years of being in another culture or being in the U.S. for the first 5, 6, 7, 10 years, the most significant shift that I experienced was to really realize how diverse South Asian identity was. And also like to take a freer understanding and ownership with the syncretic and very complex history of South Asia. So I became incredibly interested in overlapping themes in visual arts between, you know, everything, Buddhism, Jainism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, all of that. All of those traditions percolate in the South Asian idea of visual identity. They're all there. They have all played a role and have, they're so layered. And so that became, understanding that was something that was natural in having kind of a distance. So on leaving, say, your city, wherever we live, like kind of moving away from that objectivity that comes with distance,
right?
That played a role for sure. And so I became more interested in reading books or gravitating to historical, you know, literature and poetry, as well as digging deeper into the different sort of ways of understanding some of that South Asian identity and its complexity.
Was there something that shocked you? Was there something that you discovered about South Asian identity and you were like, wow, I didn't know this growing up in Pakistan?
Well, I think growing up in that time before internet and, you know, of course, as I'm sure you know, traveling to India was never simple. I think I had only been there once for a short trip, but you couldn't just get up and travel to India. You could never get visas. And so that lack of familiarity and yet knowing that, you know, pre-partition, the cultures were so, like, there was no Pakistan. So what is a Pakistani identity? Why is it always in this kind of very complex and twisted, and the paradox of it is that it's not just, you know, so many years old, it's deeper. So when it's deeper, then how do you take ownership of that, of that history before before Pakistan comes into being? So what started to happen for me was that my work started to, I would say, breach the national boundaries. That's definitely something that starts to happen in the work. And so at that time, it's not just about, oh, it's all, the work is becoming American. I think the work is questioning some of these nationalistic boundaries and categories.
How restrictive do you think it is for an artist, especially like yourself, who is exploring ideas of tradition and culture? And as you mentioned, there was no Pakistan before partition. So there is a lot of overlap in terms of artistic expression, in terms of different art forms that are used between India and Pakistan. How restrictive do you think it is for you to not be able to explore that part of it because you cannot travel to India as much, or because of all the crazy geopolitics of that region?
Definitely. I think in the early years when I was wanting to, say, go work in Baroda with a couple of artists, Ghulam Sheikh and Anilama Sheikh, as a much younger artist, I was keen to go there. US was not something that I was thinking about. And my inability to actually get the visas, or the political situation being such that, you know, one couldn't just get up and go work in Baroda. So then that itself was incredibly disappointing. And coming to the US behind that is like, you know, wanting to do other things, but not being able to. So this traveling on a Pakistani passport for all these years, I'm sure all Pakistanis relate to that. Like the difficulty in getting visas, even for many years, even a visa to the UK, while being in the US on a green card and wanting to go, even if I had an exhibit in the UK, there were times when, you know, when the visa application was ridiculous, like 40 pages.
This episode is presented by Away Travel. Quite simply, Away makes everything you need for trip away. It's a perfect suitcase for somebody like me who travels long distance and wants to stay connected on the go. My favorite color, blush. Away started with the perfect suitcase, then built from there, creating a range of travel standards developed from the travel stories of friends and seatmates. The pieces aren't smart, they are thoughtful, with features that solve real travel problems. Your Away suitcase will be with you for life. And we at Immigrantly are so excited to be teaming up with Away and Podgo to give you the best deal on premium luggage by going to podgo.co/away. That's podgo.co/away. Away Travel is here to make your journey seamless. I want to go back to your decision to come to the US, because I think we were going to talk about that and then we pivoted to something else. Why did you decide to come to the US, and what was that experience like the first time you landed here?
So that's a very, actually such a wonderful story, because when I graduated from the National College of Arts in 1991, there was my thesis that I put forth. You know, it got a lot of attention. It argued that the craft-based engagement with miniature painting, and you could insert experimentation with that, like it argued for it and questioned the prejudices we collectively had towards that. And it encouraged a lot of students to join in. And all of a sudden, there was a huge group of people wanting to study miniature painting. So I was asked to come and teach. I was really young, and many of the students were just a year or two younger to me. And, you know, it was exciting, but at the same time, the politics of academia are harsh. And I knew that either I would have to just learn to deal with that and put all my time and energy into that, or I still needed to grow as an artist. So I think at that time, I was wanting to look for support or, you know, financial aid or scholarships to go study further. And I started to look where I would like to go. So I wanted to go to Baroda, but I couldn't. You know, most faculty, not most, but several faculty has gone to London. So of course, then several colleges of London would come up, like Slade or RCA, or at that time, I think those two. And then I remember applying, getting into Slade, not having the financial means, because then at that time, I wrote to the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Abida Hussain, and that they should support our art. Art.
Right.
It would be good for diplomacy also, right? So like, and that they should support young artists. So I remember getting that conversation with her after a year of writing and visiting her. And eventually, like, they asked me that if I wanted to show my work, I could send it to accompany a March 23rd event.
Okay.
That's kind of, I was going to send my art, and literally I think several days before the work was to be sent, I was told I could travel standby and actually bring my work with me. So that was my first trip. It was a standby ticket on Pakistani Airlines to exhibit my work at the Pakistani Embassy in Washington, D.C. in 1993.
And did you go back to Pakistan then?
Yeah, so I arrived, and at that time you could get, for tourists, there was a Sea America ticket. And that was something that my father got me, which was amazing, because you could travel around the U.S. anywhere as many times. It was an unlimited, like those Eurotrail tickets that used to be, it was on Delta. And it was on standby, but it was valid for a few months. So you could travel as many times as long as you could get a seat. So I had that with me. The work was up at the Pakistani embassy for a day or maybe a few days. Nobody bought anything. The work was so... I had priced it all under maybe $100 or $50.
Oh, wow.
And I was so disappointed when nobody purchased anything. And, you know, they were all like Pakistani expats, right? From D.C., mostly probably doctors or people that work in the banks. And you know, so that right there and then you can see like nobody wanted to support a young artist. Nobody wanted to buy or thought worthy of buying a piece of art. And they were all small drawings. There were, I think, more than 40 such drawings that I had hung there. Not a single work sold.
I'm sure, Shazia, they regret it now.
but like the beauty of that is that it fired me up. I was, of course, disappointed. But then I had all that material. So I put it in a portfolio, called up various art schools, went and visited the schools and got myself, I think I got admission into 3 or 4 schools.
Wow.
And at that time it was okay, let's see, you know, where I could get financial assistance also. So I sat in the library, I think in Chicago, and read through a book somebody had given me and came across a kind of a scholarship fund or what something for graduate students based on the premise that if you got it and they paid towards it, it would become a loan if you stayed in the country. Whatever you were acquiring as a master's, you would go back and put it into application. So kind of, you know, things like that I remember reading and coming across. I applied. It was a women chapterhood that ended up paying towards tuition. I shared that with another Pakistani artist. She also got the same thing that paid towards her schooling. So, you know, it was just this situation where you had to learn to be resourceful. But in my early experience of the U.S., it was that if you dug deeper, you could find resources.
So you finish your master's and then you decide to stay here. What triggered that?
Yeah, so I think as a foreign student, you get a year that comes along on the student visa,
right,
where you can put whatever you've acquired, you can put it into application, right? I forget the term of that period, but you get 1 year to continue in the US.
I think it's called OPT, if I'm not mistaken.
So I had that, and I knew that, you know, okay, I wanted to look for a job. So I was applying for teaching jobs after I finished my master's, which was at the Rhode Island School of Design. And then also I started applying for residencies. That's another platform for artists. So I decided to do a residency with the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. So I did that. It was for a year, and then it was renewable for another year. And in that period, I applied for a green card based on, I think, a category called extraordinary ability. And I was able to get it. But the actual card didn't happen for 8 years.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it takes so long, the process itself.
That itself was such a dilemma because I couldn't travel in that entire period. And that is a very long time. You know, like the world changed. 9/11 happened. I was unable to travel. So that created this kind of a further sort of a rift or distancing where I didn't see family for many years. I couldn't go back and forth. But, you know, but at the same time, then I was like, okay, I'll take, I just took that time and started to, you know, make work and delve deeper. And I was, in 97, I think I got into the Whitney Biennial. I got into some other shows in New York. So I decided to take that plunge and move there rather than go in the direction of teaching, because I had a job that I had applied to and that I had gotten, which was at the University of Texas, Austin.
How was the teaching experience? Did you teach at all?
I have taught here and there, but never full time.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I was teaching at Brooklyn College as well as Columbia. I continue to work with graduate students, you know, where I can go visit them, see their work, have conversations around their particular practice, as well as, you know, talk about the actual studio practice and then also a much more critical approach to understanding and talking through them with them, what their work means. So I kind of do that all over the country.
Shazia, I read somewhere that when you moved to the US, you started to wear a veil in public and you called it a performance. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that was just part of a class project. And I know that it has been like something like that will get blown up.
So what was the trigger behind it and what were you trying to achieve through it?
You know, basically that really was how, unfortunately, the persistence of the veiled character, it kind of persists in the Western imagination.
Right.
And I was questioning, I think it was a project that one was doing with reading Fatima Mernissi. So questioning, you know, a lot of feminist scholars. And I was juxtaposing people that I had been reading, which were basically the Western scholars like Helen Susu, even like bell hooks and Julia Kristeva, etc., Angela Carter, but then also like juxtaposing, bringing in conversations, Ismat Chughtai, Fahmida Riaz, Kishwar Nahid, even Praveen Shakir and Fatima Mernissi, and then questioning, you know, how certain representations persist. So that was done with that kind of idea in mind in terms of, you know, how even at that time, yeah, that's when this kind of save Muslim women is a premise for the invasion of Afghanistan, too.
Right.
So like how some of those aspects get pronounced and how, you know, where that idea is coming from, how deeply rooted is this sort of Orientalist deep-rooted ideas and fetish. So that's what I was questioning, because I wanted to understand what it meant as a problematic icon, as an image that, you know, that no matter what, who I was, this is something that was always being projected onto me. No matter what, like, you were in the US and you would be asked to represent a big culture, you would be asked to speak on behalf of a culture. Or the stereotype idea that persisted about that culture, right? So it was a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing that I did, but I also was curious that what would happen if I actually, how do people respond and behave?
So how did they?
Yeah, it was all very, you know, it was interesting. It was either you were anonymous or you stood out. And then also you could offend others or stood. And it was just within the institution. So it wasn't like, so it's like an art school project.
That's so interesting. Because I know I've read about how your work also explores different dimensions of female identity, right? And we talk a lot about identity on Immigrant Leave, but what I find fascinating or interesting about talking about identity, especially female identity in America, is that there are so many contradictions. Because on the one hand, for instance, I consider myself an immigrant, a woman of color, Pakistani woman. Now, all of this does bring a lot of nuances, but sometimes it becomes restrictive because everybody is like filtering through those labels and seeing me in the context of all those collective labels, right? How do you navigate these dynamics in your work, all these different layers of identity as a woman with multitude of layers?
Yeah, I think the paradox is always there, you know, just kind of to close that earlier topic we were talking about. It was for me when I kind of, you know, say did the performance, I was also soliciting how people's reactions were towards me, towards that idea. I was also looking at how identity is so mercurial. Like, if I wore it now, is everybody going to think of me a certain way? If I took it off, is that going to become a gesture in of itself? So I was questioning how, you know, mask, the identity is such a mask, it's on the surface.
Right.
And so as I developed my paintings of that era, it became that image is very traumatized image. It's an image which almost looks like a kind of a armature, or like a perforated armor or a shelter or a shell, because maybe it's that shuttlecock burqa, all kind of a haunted image. So that was, for me, that was really that cage-like form that emerges in some of that work. And maybe we can show that work. When I made that, it has a door. It has a pink heart that's kind of lurking inside. But I was also tapping into my anxiety of being boxed into a stereotype on behalf of a culture or religion. As an artist, you know, you're questioning things that are culturally prevalent, but that are historically embedded also in this kind of the whole history of how West, these monolithic categories of West versus East, West versus Islam.
Right.
These are very problematic spaces. And then also in terms of being a person of color, or who's seen as the immigrant, who's seen. So when you think of like, who's the other, who's the outsider, what is Asian, what is oppressive, what is free, like these types of dichotomies that start to kind of linger in that language, especially in the US, in terms of who belongs with us and who's the outsider.
That's so true. And especially, I mean, when it comes to topics of immigration, specifically borders, right?
Borders and even feminism. Even when you think as a female artist, you know, if I was to locate, say, the South Asian representation in that time in the 90s, in the feminist space, art history books of 1990s, you know, often just said, third world feminism, and that was it. It was like this very big category in which, you know, you were supposed to just sit in there. That types of, say, what do you call it? Like the blind spots of white feminism, those exclusions that were very prevalent, you know, so that then you have to intellectually diversify the space too, not just racially.
Yeah, and we see that now. There are more, I guess, palatable labels. I don't call myself a feminist. I call myself an intersectional feminist because my experiences as a feminist are not the same as white feminists' experiences. And that's the reality that we all have to reconcile with, because it adds a different layer of nuance and identity that people who are like women who are white and identify as feminists may not be able to relate to. Shazi, in your work, I see that most of your artistry is impacted by environmental context. And we've talked about it. You've experimented with it. You have basically taken different forms, dismantled and rebuilt them. What kind of creative process do you go through or you find yourself when it comes to responding to certain environmental contexts? Because sometimes what you're capturing as an artist, something that you're creating may be beautiful, but it's based on something traumatic or something horrific, right?
Climate change, climate issues, those are kind of all, you know, again, deeply rooted to the whole mechanism, you know, of power and resources, how trade functions, right? So if you look at the migration patterns, you also look at the history of trade and how commodities and bodies shift across geographies, and those are violent histories. Those are histories that have been about extraction too. So yeah, so I think in that, with that, that theme has also emerged in my work. Recent films that I've done, which really kind of play with this sort of struggle between nature and human, and also the dynamics, how, you know, death plays a role in so many genres, like revolutionary poetry, the kind of language of the garden or the revolution, the garden as the chaman, right?
Right.
That idea, what it means in terms of this kind of dance of metamorphosis, humans' participation in nature. So there's a whole kind of animation process that I've done, which plays with this idea of how human exists in the world. And and then there are more paintings where literally, you know, I'm looking at as the symbols of extraction, and over there I'm looking at the history of oil. There's a series called The Christmas Trees, where literally the oil rigs were called Christmas trees. When I was doing research, they were in from British Petroleum magazines from 1960s in the UAE, in Oman, in that region. Oil rigs are first called Christmas trees. So when I came across those photographs, I was, I didn't know that was the term. And they didn't look like trees. They were just like rigs, you know. So I kind of was like, okay, I'm going to question that. Is it this very ingenious English wit on the gift-bearing capacity of the oil rigs or what? So I did a whole series, which there's a series called Oil and Poppies, where they also kind of, the oil rigs that have been made into Christmas trees exist also in conversation with the opium flower. But it's sort of it alludes to the opium industry in Afghanistan and the long-term U.S. intervention and conflict there. So, you know, then there's another one, there's a series called Flared, which again was on the climate crisis, the endless wildfires that were in California and other parts, you know, like in Australia also. So there's a whole series around that too. So it was about, you know, what the images, the symbols of extraction.
Hmm.
How do you counter that with what is then the counter to that? What is abundance? And is that human imagination? Is it literature, the art?
Right. So with COVID, I believe things have changed. But are there any upcoming exhibitions that people can look forward to or go and see in person? Or is everything online still?
No, I think a lot of the work is online in general, I think, in the art world. But shows are happening. I recently had an exhibition in New York that was in November, December. And the next one is going to open in June at the Morgan Library Museum in Manhattan. That is actually a retrospective of my work. So you will be able to see that in person. It'll be up for several months. And then that work travels to the Rhode Island School of Design's museum and then to the Museum of Fine Art in Houston. So it sort of follows my trajectory because I came to Providence, then moved to Texas, to Houston, and then moved to New York. So
Shazia, where can people find your work online?
Yes, my website is very concise. There's a lot of information available. It's just shaziasikandar.com.
And in the end, I ask my guests this question. I want to get your answer on it, especially because you're an artist and you do explore the nuances of cultures and traditions. If you were to describe America, how would you do that?
Well, for me, I think America is really a place which is constantly shifting and changing and morphing, and it's a shapeshifter. And I kind of, in that way, I think of it as another protagonist in the work. And that's how it's a place where, you know, there's always this language, geography, identity, borders. They are constantly in flux.
If you were to create some kind of a painting or an art form out of this, like, idea of how you see America, what do you think it would look like?
Well, I did make a painting.
Oh, you did?
Yes. It is about American imperial history, about American capital, and also its interface with Islamic countries.
Oh,
and
wow.
You can look it up. It's on it will be on display also at the Morgan Museum. But it was actually done for a New York Times magazine in 1999. Where they invited artists to imagine what would be kind of the big issue in the millennium.
Huh.
And I proposed that the U.S. foreign policy in Islamic countries would be a very polarizing idea and something that would occupy us. And this was 2 years before 9/11 happened.
Wow. Wow.
And so that work, I think, is a very interesting work because it does center with the Statue of Liberty and also two characters. There is an inscription from the Quran, which is placed on the American currency. And, you know, it's got a lot of different players and their portraits in there. So it's sort of the shifting global alliances over the years, over the last several years between Muslim leaders and the American empire. Yeah, it's about war, coalitions, sanctions, debts, human rights, military muscle, all of that. And so I would say that, you know, I've done a piece like that, and I don't think we have changed that much.
That's what I was going to ask you. Would you create a different piece now that it's been 20 years? But it seems like what you're describing hasn't, like...
Yeah, it's called... you know, again, I think, of course, over there, I think one thing that is very interesting is that in that painting, when it's done, Iraq, you know, Saddam Hussein is our friend, not a foe.
Oh.
So you can see how that happens, how, you know, the alternating notion of friend and foe.
That's so fascinating, Shazia. I can't wait to see that painting.
Yes, it's online. You can. Yeah. It was reviewed also in Hyperallergic. In a recent exhibition, which was at the Asia Society. So you can, if you typed it in, it will show up. It's called The Many Faces of Islam.
Oh, interesting. Thank you so much, Hazia. This was so good. Thank you for taking the time out. I know you're busy and you're a great artist, and I can't wait to check your exhibition in June and this particular painting now.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Sadia, to this platform. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to, you know, to the summer, to being able to show you the work in person.
Okay, what a fun interview. Don't forget to check Shazia's painting. I am so excited. I am going to do that right after I wrap up this interview. Don't forget to check our Patreon and our GoFundMe. Our website is immigrantlypod.com. Until next time, take care.